The debate over nature versus nurture is becoming a lot more complicated these days thanks to a relatively new field of study called epigenetics. It's at the center of a revolution happening in the world of genetics, and it's challenging much of what we think we know about how our bodies develop, let alone our minds. So as the concept of epigenetics slowly begins to wend its way into our discussions about genes and destiny, we thought we'd offer a primer on the subject, and to help us, The Current's producer Jeff Warren is in our studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Anne-Maria.
Now, Jeff, I know this is going to get more complicated as we go along, so let's just be as simple as possible at the beginning here. Define epigenetics.
Well, you know I can't do anything simply, so I'm going to give you two answers to this. There's the hysterical, hyperbole-heavy answer and the more sober, scientific one. The hysterical one is epigenetics is an idea that will change everything you think you know about genes, identity, and fate.
Fate as well. Okay, I can follow that. Now, what's the scientific one?
Well, the scientific answer is epigenetics is it's a kind of shorthand for all the materials and processes that are associated with our DNA, but that are not the actual raw physical material of the DNA itself.
So the stuff that makes our DNA work.
Very close to that, yeah. So one strand of DNA has about 25,000 genes, and as everybody knows, each of those genes contains instructions on how to build some part of the body. I'm sure you've heard the word blueprint. It often comes up in discussions about DNA. Well, it turns out that the genes themselves also need instructions. They need direction on where and when to be turned on or off, whether to build a brain or a liver, muscle, or bone.
And the epigenome is that set of instructions.
Exactly. And those instructions come in the form of what they call chemical markers. And it's these chemical markers that guide genetic development.
Okay, so now if I remember correctly, the prefix epi means something like outside or around, right?
It does. So these instructions, these markers, they're a kind of metaphorical wrapper for the DNA. Now, I should just say here quickly, this description is limited. There are all kinds of different processes and aspects of the genome. Some act like a wrapper, some do not.
Okay, well, let's focus on the wrapper aspect because I'm looking at you and I see you're sitting there with an O. Henry bar on the table next to you. And my guess is you're not hungry, right? What are you doing?
No, so I brought this in as a kind of visual aid. So this chocolate bar we see right here, this nice O. Henry chocolate bar, is wrapped up in a nice yellow wrapper. Now, to get the good stuff inside, I have to kind of make a hole in it. So hold on. So okay, this is plastic wrapper. It's very difficult to get into. So okay, I'm making a little hole in the chocolate bar right here in the wrapper of the O. Henry. Now, if I want to nibble a peanut off the bar, it's bloody hard wrappers.
I'm very good at that.
I make a hole in it like so, and here you go. Here's my peanut.
Okay, and that would be a gene, right? The peanut in the O. Henry bar.
Right. So inside each cell of our body, you have a long strand of DNA. That's the chocolate bar. The epigenome, or at least the part of the epigenome we're talking about, is like the chocolate bar's external wrapper. It kind of slides and shifts around over top. Now, the key here is that if some part of the bar inside, the genes, wants to express itself, it has to do so through an opening in the metaphorical wrapper. Now, scientists used to think only the DNA chocolate bar was important, but now they realize the epigenetic wrapper also has a really important part to play, and it plays by very different rules.
And what do you mean it plays by different rules?
Well, this gets at what's so cool and paradigm-shaking about all of this. Unlike our genes, which in effect get passed down blindly from generation to generation, the epigenome is incredibly malleable. It's sensitive to changes in the environment, and human beings, as we know, have the ability to control aspects of our environment. What this means is we have the ability to actually influence the expression of our genes.
Okay, so let me get this straight. By changing some aspect of our environment, we can change the wrapper. And in doing so, we control which gene is expressed when?
Right. The line popular science writers have been using is, genes are not fate. We're beginning to see how we can actually shape elements of our genetic makeup.
Which is a very big deal if you have a gene for some certain disease.
Exactly.
So let's backtrack a bit before we get into some of the implications of this. Where and when did all of this thinking start?
Well, it actually started a while ago, back in the 70s. And one of the pioneers back then was a young McGill pharmacologist named Moshe Sif. Dr. Sif is still at McGill. I want you to meet him now. Here he is describing the original research he was doing that tipped him off to the importance of epigenetics. He's going to talk about markers. And remember, that's our set of genetic instructions.
I was interested in mechanisms that lead to cancer. And there was a strong school that suggested that cancer is in our genes. That is, we inherit bad genes that increase our propensity to develop cancer later in life. And the genetic theory was very dominant and still is dominant in understanding cancer. But the question that I was looking into was, are there mechanisms that are what we call then epigenetic around the genes that can also be involved in leading to cancer? One of the proteins that I was interested in was the protein that is called, in our language, DNA methyltransferase, which really means a protein that marks our genes with small chemicals. And I found that the protein that marks the DNA is very highly active in cancer cells. And I suggested that if one can block that protein, one can perhaps reverse the cancer state. And that's what's fascinating about those markings. The genes we inherit and we can't change. However, the markings could be changed because an independent machinery is laying down these markings. And that machinery could put them on and take them off. And that machinery is responsive to signals that come from the environment and from our body. And therefore, there is hope that if we can change those markings, we can reverse cancer.
That's extraordinary. We can reverse cancer. We would have all thought that was impossible.
Well, that was the response Dr. Sift faced as well. At the time, everyone resisted his findings, and a reviewer of a science journal even called his ideas a misguided attempt at scientific humor. But in the end, Dr. Sift was vindicated. By targeting those markings, the epigenetic machinery, the wrapper we've been talking about, he's been able to eliminate tumors in mice. Now, today there are thousands of papers on the subject, and most geneticists accept that epigenetic factors play a role in disease. Dr. Sift himself has even started a company that'll one day, depending on how the clinical trials go, make available anti-cancer drugs that target the genome. Now, none of this has eliminated cancer, of course, but it has been a very big step in understanding and combating the disease.
So what we're basically talking about is using a drug to turn on or turn off different genes that can lead to disease.
And that's just the beginning. We're just getting started here, Anna Maria. The epigenetic revolution goes way deeper, because what Dr. Sift became interested in next was not just disease, but also behavior.
Oh, so this is the nurture part of nature and nurture.
Scientists have known for a while that certain genes regulate behavior in animals. Well, Dr. Sift wondered whether the epigenetic wrapper might also do something similar, whether it actually affected behavior. Since the wrapper seemed to be so plastic and malleable, might it be possible to molecularly turn on and off the way animals act or respond?
And?
Well, the answer, it turns out, amazingly, is yes. This is best seen in the work of another McGill researcher, a psychology colleague of Dr. Sift's named Michael Meany. Meany was interested in a particular gene that shaped stress receptors in the brains of rats, the parts of the brain that regulate the stress response. He found that depending on the kind of relationship baby rats had with their mothers, the gene could be turned on or it could be turned off. This would then initiate a behavior, a positive or negative response to stress, that would develop later in life. Here's Dr. Sift again explaining his and Michael Meany's work.
What Michael found was that based on the quality of maternal care, if one can say, in the rats, the offspring, as they mature to become adult rats, have different behaviors. For example, those rats that were exposed to high maternal licking and grooming, which is maternal care in the rat, will cope with stress better later in life than rats that were not exposed to the same quality of maternal care. So what we did is we looked at those adult rats and we asked the question, could we change it? For example, could we change a rat that had high maternal care and make it now look as if it has low maternal care, or vice versa? Can we change a rat that when it was a little pup had low maternal care and convert it to a rat that behaves like a rat that has high maternal care? And we used two kinds of manipulations. One manipulation was a drug that affects the epigenetic machinery directly, and we could convert the low rats to behave like the high rats. And we exposed them to a number of tests after we injected the drug into the adult rats. So here we have rats that by their maternal care should have been low, but we converted them with a drug to behave as high rats. And vice versa, we injected methionine, which is a food component, into the brain of high rats, and converted them to behave as if they had low maternal care. So here, by one manipulation, we can change the behavior of an adult animal from what its mother programmed it to be.
So, Jeff, Dr. Siff is talking about behavior modification.
Right, behavior modification in rats. But, I mean, I guess the thing is, as rats aren't humans, but as fellow mammals, we probably share a similar mechanism for these kinds of things. So it could apply to us as well. Now, I just want to reinforce these findings. Anna Maria, we know there are correlations between our genes and our behaviors, and this is often seen in a kind of fatalistic way, that we're somehow pre-programmed. Well, what Moshe Siff and Michael Meany did was show, in rats at least, that it's possible to change the programming, not before we're born, but actually in life.
And so that, I guess, has the potential to say that the genes that we are born with aren't necessarily the only influence in our physical makeup and behavior.
Right. Genes are not fate. So not only is it possible to disable genes responsible for disease, but we can even change specific behaviors by targeting the epigenome.
And this would be where the nature versus nurture debate gets a little more complicated.
Yes. The usual route for nurture is the learning of new behaviors through behavior modeling. So we act a certain way because we saw a mom act a certain way. But this is different. These adult rats didn't learn new behaviors. They had their brains injected with a chemical that in turn triggered a new behavior. So as Dr. Siff told me, behavior has a molecular basis. So when it comes to nature-nurture then, it's more like nature via nurture. Genes affect our bodies and personalities, but they depend, at least in some cases, on a particular configuration of environmental conditions to be expressed. In other words, what we experience in our lives, both physical and emotional, can affect how our genes are expressed. This is the Epigenetic Revolution, Part 1.
Part 1. There's more.
There is more. And the second part is even crazier. Because what some of the most recent findings are showing is that these epigenetic changes don't just stop with the individual. They can actually be passed down through generations.
They can be inherited.
Right. Some of the environmental changes we've been talking about that can happen to us in life can also get handed down to our kids. There's a kind of echo of individual experience that sounds down between the generations. So this is a crazy concept, and to get some perspective on what this means, I called up a philosophy of science professor at Tel Aviv University named Eva Jablonka. Now, Professor Jablonka recently published a book on epigenetics called Evolution in Four Dimensions. She's done more thinking on the subject than almost anyone else on the planet. Here she is.
What is clearer and clearer is many things that happen to you during your development can affect your offspring, many more than we thought. We thought that there is a delete button and everything that happened during your development is sort of completely deleted and the next generation starts afresh. But it appears not to be the case. We don't know the scope of it, certainly not. We're only beginning to uncover how general the phenomenon is and to see exactly what is and what is not changed. But certainly, things that happen during development can affect the next generation and the next generation and the generation after. I mean, heredity is simply a much, much broader phenomenon than we thought for the last, century, I guess.
Interesting. And that's why, of course, her book is called Evolution in Four Dimensions, because of the evolutionary side of this. So, Jeff, what kinds of things are we talking about here that would get past that delete button?
Well, mostly they seem to be things related to diet and the various chemicals we're exposed to in life. So there's a very famous example of a Dutch famine where young women who were starved when they were young end up having smaller children, who in turn end up having smaller children, and so on through the generations. And there are also, you know, chemical effects, so things like pesticides, insecticide, and even some evidence to suggest smoking. All these are thought to affect the epigenome, which can cause problems in generation after generation of offspring.
So this is a very big deal.
It's a huge deal, and we've hardly begun to even think about the implications. Professor Jablonka is one of the few who has. Here she is again.
Let's say that we're living in a utopic kind of world. Everything is good, and everybody has enough food and shelter, and there are no terrible stresses, no wars, and no other horrible things that can affect the developmental system very badly. And so on. And then you say, okay, we have changed the world. Now everybody is equal. Everybody starts from the same kind of developmental starting line, and all the differences are in genes, and that's it. But that's not true, because if there is carryover of all these things from the past, we have to know how to counter it. We have some control over the gene expression patterns, to some extent at least. we're only scratching the surface of a very big iceberg. As we realize that what we do and the way that what we do to the world and what we eat and what how we behave and all this kind of thing can have transgenerational effects, affect our children and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren and so on. I think this gives us a greater responsibility.
I guess we've got something else to be responsible for. But it's not just that the consequences of our actions in life change our environments. Now they actually change the expression of our genes or our kids' genes as well.
In some cases, it does seem to be the case, yeah. Now, the important thing to point out here is scientists don't know whether these things that make it past the cross-generational delete button are just flukes or whether there's a deeper set of laws at work here. So there's a lot more research to be done. Scientists are now talking about starting up a human epigenome project, a huge, much more complicated mirror of the human genome project that scientists undertook a few years back. So this project would track all the epigenetic markings that we've been talking about.
Okay, well, Jeff, you've only mentioned the negative things that get passed down, though. Starvation leading to smaller babies, pesticides, smoking. Is it only the bad things that can make it through?
Well, that's one of the things I find so fascinating about all of this. It's so new, we just do not know the scope. Most of the examples we've seen so far are negative. They're about when things go wrong. Pollution, stress, chemicals, and diet causing disease and pathology. And that's what science does. It tracks the problems to find solutions. You know, scientific developments can also ripple out into our lives in a more personal way, too. And that's what I kept turning over and over in my head as I was researching this story.
But I'm still thinking about the mother rats licking the baby rats and how that altered their stress receptors and their personalities later in life.
Yeah, you have to think that if much of what goes wrong is connected to the epigenome, then much of what's good in us is also connected. So beyond all the talk of disease and problems, what does this new understanding mean for human beings personally? It wasn't until I spoke with a friend of mine that I got the answer I was looking for. My friend's name is Robin Bates. Originally from Toronto, Robin now lives in New York with her husband and her daughter. One night we were out for dinner, and I was telling Robin about all this, and she listened. And then she told me about her grandmother and her daughter, Elise.
Oh, my grandmother was born on the border of Alberta and Saskatchewan in a town called Alsace in a sod hut. And Elise is born in New York City, and I often look at Elise and I think that whole history of my grandmother is in Elise. And my grandmother, her mom died in childbirth, and she really raised her siblings, and she had a lot of pain and suffering. And I know that history is in my daughter, and I think a lot about that. My grandmother used to tell us a lot of her stories and talked a lot about everything from the way it was out there to meeting my grandfather and listening to him play piano and what it was like to live in Toronto, the things that they did. And her experiences are in Elise. I see that. Sometimes there's a look in Elise's face and I think, oh, that's Nana. And I think about when my grandmother died. I didn't know where she went. I don't come from a family that believes in God, and I wish that we did sometimes. It would be easier to understand where my grandmother had gone afterwards. But I remember standing at a bus stop and realizing, oh, she's in me, Nana's in me, and I'm responsible now. I'm responsible for the rest of her memories and her being, that she rose up in me, and I feel that way about Elise. I feel like she has risen up in Elise, too.
That's a lovely image.
It's a really nice idea, and I don't actually know how much of it is poetry and how much we may one day find out is actually true. All I know is, you know, as I was researching this and thinking about this and talking to my friends about it, is that it seems important. You know, the notion that our ancestors live in us, not just through the raw material of their genes and their example in life, but also through their own experiences before we're even born, that we may contain kind of inside us this environmental memory or echo, the smells of the old country, the things our grandparents ate, their actual life experiences.
They're within us.
They might be in some way.
Okay, so if we're going to recap then, we have these metaphorical wrappers inside us that can be changed by the environment and potentially passed down through generations, all of which gives us the amazing potential to shape and control genetic inheritance in ourselves and in our children and in our children's children.
A masterly summary. The science is just beginning. But it definitely opens up doors that weren't there before. I spoke to an editor at the New Scientist magazine, and he told me that even though this research began 20 to 30 years ago, it's only now really taking off as a subject. So we can expect to read a lot more about it in the years to come.
And that we'll be reading about epigenetics then.
We'll be reading about epigenetics.
I guess it's taken them that long to do the work and to be able to present us with, the rest of us, with things we'll understand.
Well, it's so complicated. It just takes a very long time for the popular media to get hold of any one part.
Jeff Warren, thank you.
Thank you.
Jeff Warren is a producer on The Current.